message. We have AA speaker, and she's just a crackerjack, and I'm sure she has a good story for us. Courtney, would you come up?
My name's Courtney Cody. I'm a crackerjack and an alcoholic. Happy Father's Day to all the devoted dads out there. God bless you. And God bless the five people that got up here and got your desire chips. I didn't have the guts to do that when I first came here. I don't know if it was pride or fear, and I surely couldn't have gotten up behind a podium. I was at the Broadway meeting, and I'll never forget it. And there was it was huge. It was down there on Broadway and Primrose at that church. And they asked, you know, anybody here for your first meeting? And I've told this so many times, and there was a woman named Barbara, and she said, yeah, my name's Barbara, and I'm an alcoholic, and she was crying, and I just went, oh, man, there's no way I'm getting up there. And I just couldn't do it. Everybody was, yay, Barbara, and I just, no way. So I surely couldn't have gotten up here. So God bless you guys. I hope if you are truly an alcoholic that you keep coming back, and this is a way of life that you can't even imagine. And my voice is just gone this morning, so I hope you bear with me. The other thing I want to say before I get started is Claire asked me to speak about a month ago. It was after one of these Sunday speaker meetings, and she said she had to find some speakers and asked me if I'd speak in June, right? Yeah, in the month of June, and would I pick a Sunday? And I went, oh, okay, well, I don't want to do that AA Al-Anon Sunday. Let me think. She said, well, think about it, and I'll come back to you. And then she came back, and she said, well, the only Sunday left is that Al-Anon AA Sunday. And I know, great, because it's hard to pack everything in just a short amount of time, so I'm going to do my best. One of the reasons it's hard to do this Sunday and pack everything in is because I'm so passionate about recovery, and I don't know if sometimes I kind of bounce around. I don't know if God's given me a thought or if I'm just a bit scatterbrained or crackerjack. So anyway, I'm going to do the best I can. I grew up in Corpus, and there's six of us kids. My parents were divorced, but they first had three of us kids. I had two older brothers and then myself, and my parents divorced. And my mother's father was the first pediatrician in Corpus, and he died 3 days after I was born, and so I never knew him. But he was very revered, and I always heard about him because, you know, he's the first pediatrician, and just, oh, he was so wonderful, and he was so wonderful. And he had died of a heart attack in his sleep. And as I got older, I heard the true story that he was addicted to Demerol, and he probably overdosed. And so the fruit doesn't fall far from the tree. And so my dad lived here in San Antonio, and I always had a good relationship with him. He was very involved with my two brothers and myself. But I always looked up to my two brothers, and then my mother remarried when I was like three, and then that stepdad brought in a little girl into our family who was just a year older than me, and my mother never accepted this little girl, so I was just like her only girl. And then my stepdad and my mother had two boys, so it was like all boys and me. And but anyway, my oldest brother was an identified alcoholic in our family, and then my other brother. So I went to parochial school, and I was just the big shot, the crackerjack, always in my parochial school. I was really somebody. But in junior high, my mother switched me over to private school, and I looked kind of like I do now. I had short hair, a little bitty, flat-chested, underdeveloped, and seventh grade. I don't know if y'all have any kids that are in seventh grade, don't bring them around me because I'll beat the shit out of them. I mean, Howard, I've worked the fourth step around that, and I still resent the hell out of seventh graders. I mean, I have lived a pretty full life, a colorful life, and still today, that's the worst year of my life. And I got bullied, and I was picked on. I went from being all that in parochial school into seventh grade, and you know, I was just this little underdeveloped little kid that looked like a little boy and was beat up on. But my brother, who was who I call my hero brother, he was one of the first surfers in Corpus, and he was so cool, and he was so good looking and real popular and everything, and I worshiped the ground he walked on. And I remember one time we were driving up to San Antonio, and my mom's yellow Impala, and the Beatles song that was playing, that song, Hello, 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 I don't know why you say goodbye, say hello, the Beatles song. And my brother was driving, and he said, Courtney, and he was like 3 years older than me. It was a summer of going into the eighth grade, and I've been bullied every day in my seventh grade, coming home every day, telling my mom, if I don't get popular, I'm going to go to a different school. And Randy said, Courtney, if anybody ever offers you marijuana in school, and I said, yeah, Randy, yeah, oh my God, and he said, do it. You know, I thought he was going to give me some good brotherly advice, like, you know, and he said, do it. I went, you know, and so, sure enough, I was offered marijuana, and I did it, and then everything shifted for me. I started getting popular, and I found my groove, and I started feeling comfortable in my skin. And then and then that year was the year also that I first experimented with vodka, and also I tell you, that was just like more of that, just the same experience of feeling like I grew some, you know. And I just felt like I came into my own. I mean, everybody that stood behind this podium has the same experience, where they feel like they belonged, and that was my experience. I found my group, and nobody was going to bully me anymore. And I felt like I belonged. And also, what my brother that I idolized and I worshipped, and I knew what he was talking about, and I felt like I had a place. And then, but however, that brother, he had experimented with drugs and alcohol only a short period, and he stopped. All of a sudden, he stopped, and he became the police of all things Courtney's behavior, and he felt so guilty for turning me into this thug, and he wanted to turn me in to my parents. And I remember one time he did find me doing something, or he found a letter or something, and he told my mother, and then they were going to call my dad, who lived here in San Antonio. And my dad was he was just so you know, I was very afraid of him, and he was very stern, and everybody in my perception, everybody in San Antonio respected Randolph Coleman. And so when he got on the phone, I thought he was going to kill me, you know. And what he said to me, I'll never forget. He said, what you need now is not an angry father. You need an understanding father. And, you know, Randy, my brother, was over there thinking, you know, Dad was going to rip me up. And he was angry that my dad didn't do that anyway. So my dad was very understanding. And we just talked it out. And that's what I mean. You know, my dad was so wise. But anyway, you know, I hung up the phone and said, well, good. You know, I got over that. And I continued down the road of drinking. But I didn't turn into what my oldest brother turned in. The very first time my oldest brother, Mike, the very first time he drank alcoholically at 16, and he was gone. You know, me, I wasn't that way. I would just entertain a little bit here and there with drugs and alcohol, but Mike was gone. And the middle brother, who I really worshipped, he went on to go to college and got very successful. My oldest brother did. He went on to college, and And he got very successful too, but he also, his life got, I mean, alcohol took him out pretty quick. But for me, my story is just so weird. I have an uncle who's an actor, and I wanted to be an actor like my uncle. So when I went to college, I studied acting until my dad said he would send me to acting school in New York, where my uncle had gone. And I said, no, I'm not that dedicated, and I want to go save my brother. My oldest brother, the alcoholic. So I'm gonna switch my majors to social rehabilitation, of all things, and from acting to counseling. And so that's what I got my major in college. I was gonna save people like you. And so that's what I got my degree in, and I started counseling. And the disease wasn't evident in me. But, you know, for me, you know, this is a spiritual malady. And I just stayed one step ahead of this disease. You know, I acted out with so many things. I remember one year I was in college, and I had a boyfriend in Corpus. And when I turned 21, he called me. And I'd gone to celebrate at this bar. It was called Hole in the Wall. And it was a hole in the wall. But it brought the best music, and it was in East Texas. It brought the best music: Waylon Jennings, Ray Wiley Hubbard, all those. This is back in the 70s. The best music. So I went to celebrate my birthday, and I had some fun on my 21st birthday, and a bunch of us went to continue partying. My boyfriend called me from Corpus, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm partying, you know, I'm celebrating my 21st birthday." And he said, "Get back to your house." I went, "Okay." So we brought the party back to my house. He wanted to make sure I was not partying anymore, so I brought the party back to my house. And I still remember this, that day, to this day, that I was looking in the mirror when he called me to make sure I got home. And there was this guy behind me, just had his arm around me, and I was looking in the mirror as my boyfriend called, and he said, "Did you get home?" I said, "Yeah, I got home." And here I am looking in the mirror at myself with this guy who had his arm around me like this, just kind of dancing. You know, it's just being unfaithful. And I was drunk as a dog. You know, this is what alcohol does. You know, it just takes the morals and just throws them in the can. I did all that kind of stuff when I was in college, but I wasn't seeing, as I'm studying counseling to save all you guys, right? And so my moral compass was not good, but I wanted to save my brother. Looking in the mirror, y'all with me? You know, I'm just like, really, you hypocrite? So anyway, I got out of college and I started working in this industry. And I remember when people would say, like, say Dawn would say, you know, if I'd have her as a client, she'd say, "You're not one of us." And I'd say, "You know, I have to fall off the cliff. You know, it's going to hurt when I land, you know." But I wasn't, I felt like I was a pretty good counselor, and I was a pretty good counselor, but I hadn't yet experienced fully the magnitude of this disease yet. And it took a while. It took a while. And so what happened for me, it was so bizarre. You know, I would just stay, like I said, one step ahead, because I would act out with various different things, like that example I gave when I turned 21. You know, I wasn't full-blown yet, but the disease was messing with me a little bit. And so what I did, like when I first got out, I turned into a workaholic when I first got out of college. I was working hard. And then I got into relationships. I turned into a love addict. And then there was just many different things I'd act out with. And the way that disease manifested itself in me fully is in 1988, I developed this eating disorder for 2 months. 2 months, and it had me by the throat. And that's when I went to the Meadows, and I knew the disease had me fully. And that's why I call this thing the spiritual malady. It just got me. And so I knew then that I had acted out with so many things. And that's when I quit drinking fully. And I hadn't had any alcohol since that time. when I went to the Meadows and I saw the different ways that I act out. You put anything in front of me and I'm going to take it on and in a big way, because for me, I will act out with anything. There's many times that I see people that quit drinking and they start using food to fill that hole in the soul. And that's what I was introduced to at the Meadows in 1988. And I was working at the time at a facility as a treatment team leader. And that wonderful facility held my job so that I could go look at the way that I, what an addict I was, the way that I act out with things. And when I came back, they promoted me to program director, and God bless them, you know. And so when I came back, I started working these steps. And I want to say, when I got down to the eighth step, the first person I put that on there was my dad, because what I saw was, my belief is when we're born as precious, authentic children of God, and then we get in these dysfunctional family systems, and we start becoming who those families need us to be. And I, with my dad, I knew that I was just trying to be who he needed me to be, so that he would love me. And I owed him an amends, because he didn't even know who I was. I just was being who I thought he needed me to be, and so. He didn't know who I was, so I wanted him to just like, Dad, here it is, you know, either you're going to love me or not, but I'm going to start being who God created me to be. And I just started showing up I started being more authentic in that relationship. And thank God, because in June 14th, 2005, I found that precious man. He had had a heart attack, and I found him dead. And several years prior to that, we had developed just a really close relationship, and he got to know this crackerjack of a woman and the authentic person that God had created me to be. And had I not done that eighth step and ninth step, he would have never gotten to know me. And I know that he had loved me in his own way, but you know, I wasn't being authentic with him. And so I had been that way with a lot of people, because you know, and I think that's when we're born into dysfunctional families, we become who they need us to be. And in the same way, like when I was in that seventh grade, I just needed people to, you know, seventh grade, you know, it's an awkward time, and we just really are desperate to belong. And of course, I want you to like me today, but I'm not desperate for you to like me. And that's where I was in seventh grade. And that's what this program has taught me to be. So anyway, let me see, I'm jumping around. So in 1988, when I came in here, I started being introduced to this program, but I didn't really get fully what a drug addict I am. And I know this is an AA meeting, but I really needed to get that, and I didn't really understand it. And that's where I see the spiritual malady is. And so later on, and as I walked through this journey and really seeing, I met my husband, my former husband, at Codependence Anonymous, and we got married, and I guess that's kind of funny, right? Actually, he and his parents brought Codependence Anonymous to San Antonio, and he's, you know, a great guy, and he was in recovery as well, and you know, he's a good person, and when we got married and we had a son, and I quit working, and I said, I'm done with this field, I'm done with these alcoholics and drug addicts, and I'm going to be a stay-at-home mom and a PTA mom and a Bible study teaching mom. And And I'm done, and I'm going to be all that with staying at home and be married. And he said, good, and I let my license go. So we did that for about 12 years, and I had a surgery or two, and boy, those pills really set good with me, and I didn't see what a drug addict I am, and I just lost track of that spiritual malady, and I relapsed, and I ended up going back to treatment, and he told me if I relapsed again, he was going to divorce me, and I guess you just don't say that to somebody number one, you don't say that to somebody that's in treatment. And my counselor told him, look, you son of a bitch, don't be telling her that when she's trying to get well. She really ripped him up for saying that to me. And I just sat back and let her, you know. But anyway, I think back in my head, I just thought, you know, I wasn't happy in the marriage. And I think a year later, I remembered that remark. Now, I don't know that I did that, but at any rate, I ended up, I took somebody to a meeting and down in Corpus, and he was under the influence, and I thought I was a year in the program, and I really was doing the right thing, and this disease is so cunning, you know. I thought I was doing the right thing, and all I saw was him under the influence, and I was gone. And with 24 hours later, I was stoned. And I tell you, I'm so grateful for that experience. I don't want anyone to go out and relapse. But what I know today is the quality of my program there then and the quality of it now, because it's not about these external circumstances, because there wasn't a cloud on the horizon in my life. There wasn't anything going on with my life, nothing going on bad. I just was off center spiritually, because I tell you, when I came back to this program and got done for good and for all, I told you about my dad walking in and finding him dead. That's just one of the deaths that I walked through. Within 2 years, 6 family members died, and I was able to walk through that with grace and dignity, with my head up and straight and sober. So it's an internal condition. This program, this recovery, is about internal condition and being right spiritually. So that's why I keep talking about this spiritual malady. Because life's going to happen, guys. Stuff's going to happen when we leave this building. You know, we're gonna have arguments with our loved ones. We may get fired, or we may lose a loved one. Like I lost 6 family members, and I'm able to deal with life. But you know, it's not about all this outside stuff. It's about where we are. You know, the book talks about we have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual program. So if you stay connected up spiritually, then you're good to go. And that's why Howard was talking about, you know, he needs you guys. He needs people to pray with him. I need you guys, but you need me too. So it's a cooperative effort here. One of the things that I wanted to share with you, I have so many stories in this program. That husband, we're friends. We have kids. We have 2 kids that we have in common together. When he left me, I had to go back and get my license, and I thought it would take me 3 weeks to get a job when I came back, and you know, because I was so sought after, right after my when I was working in the field, don't you know who I am? And so you know, people went, no, you know, you don't have your license. You know, I thought it'd take me 3 weeks, and it took 13 months to find a job. And when I came back into the program, people were saying, aren't you scared? And I kept saying, you know, no, God's going to provide for me. And I just kept coming back and working my program, working with my sponsor, doing these steps, putting my resumes out there. And I thought, like I said, take me 3 weeks to get a counseling job. And so then I was going, man, you know, people aren't hiring me. This was back in 2003. And so I started broadening my horizons, you know, looking. I was just starting respecting anybody with a good day's wage, people at Valero, people just working at the shoe store, anywhere. So I was applying at boutiques, just anywhere. But I wasn't getting scared. People were saying, aren't you scared? And I'd say, no, you know, I know God's going to provide for me. And I was living in a really nice apartment close to my kids, and we would do joint custody. And then my divorce settlement money was getting gone. And I had to move, and I moved into what I called a dump that I wouldn't have lived in it when I was in college. And I was embarrassed about this dump, and I was calling it a dump. And it got down to where I was 11 months not finding a job, but I kept saying, you know, God's going to provide, God's going to provide. And then I got to where I didn't have any money, but I wasn't telling anybody. And I called my sponsor one day, and I said, you know, I was calling her, and I was crying, I was sobbing, I was under my windowsill, and I said, you know, I feel like God, like He's been betraying me like a lover, and I don't have a job. I was crying, and she said, Courtney, God's not going to provide for you because you're calling this place a dump. You're not grateful for it. And so I said, you're right, you're right. I'll get grateful for this dump. So I got off the phone, I got down on my knees, and I just got so grateful to God, and I said, thank you for this dump. I said, thank you for this house. It was a nice duplex. It was something I could afford. It was two bedrooms. I could bring my kids over. And I just got, on a cellular level, so grateful. The next day, my former husband called me, and he said, Courtney, can you come over? And I said, yes. And he was doing this Rick Warren Purpose-Driven Life series at this house, and I was doing it too at somebody else's house. And he said, and he didn't know I was having problems financially. And he said, you know, Rick Warren asked if any of us were having a resentment in our heart. And I've been having a resentment in my heart. And I don't want to have resentment in my heart at you for anymore. And he said, you know, I've been saving up for a rainy day. And I'm sitting on the couch with him like this. And he said, I think you might be having a rainy day at your house. And he throws this envelope in between us. And he said, I want you to have this. And I'm just going like this. And I went, damn, God, you waited till the 11th hour. And we talked some more, and I picked that envelope, and I went home, and I hadn't opened it, and I called him. I said, David, I don't know how much is in here, but the fact that you don't want to have a resentful heart anymore far exceeds whatever in this envelope. And I didn't know if there was $50 in there or $3,000, but I opened it up, and there was enough to get me through 2 months before I got an offer at Kathleen Summers Boutique. And what God was doing for me, I had the faith, but he was working on my grateful heart, and he was working on David's resentful heart. And so then I was taking a shower one day, and I said, God, do you want me to go back and get my LCDC or my master's? And he told me he wanted me to go back and get my LCDC license. And then I went to La Hacienda and got my license renewed. And then I just started working back in the field and became even a more passionate, understanding, deep and rich counselor. And then I'm more passionate about recovery. And by the way, while I was up there at La Hacienda, that brother that I knew I couldn't save anymore ended up dying of alcohol poisoning. But I miss him. He's the reason I'm in the field. And he also touched my life as an alcoholic. And so I'm just so dedicated to recovery. I love you guys so much. And we got to be warriors for this deal. And my brother Mike didn't die in vain. And he's precious as all of you are. Thank you.